You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Welcome to Sunday. Should Britain give asylum to Asia Bibi, the Pakistani woman whose blasphemy conviction was overturned at the end of last month? The chairman of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee has challenged the Foreign Office over Britain's stance. He'll join us live. Also in the programme, a new series on public servants and the moral questions they face. First up, a former Supreme Court President, Lord Neuberger.
If I had to point to one thing which I think disturbs me, it is the government's failure to provide proper financial and administrative basis for the judiciary and more widely for the rule of law.
And at the British Library, old books, more than a millennium old, in fact, with a very modern story to tell.
These three books really are foundational manuscripts for what was to become the Kingdom of England. And here on the left, we've got the St. Augustine Gospels, which is thought to have been brought with St. Augustine's mission to England.
On Friday, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, and Bishop Heinrich Bedford Strom of the Evangelical Church in Germany issued a joint statement calling on politicians to find what they called fair and sustainable solutions to future relations between this country and the European Union. We asked Lambeth Palace for an interview with the Archbishop, but they said no. Bishop Bedford Strom, however, agreed to speak to us, and just before we went on the air, I asked him what inspired them.
Well, we are worried about how Europe develops. There is an increase of emotion, sometimes hate, division, and we see our role as churches and as church leaders in trying to build bridges between the countries, in trying to create or help creating a debate which is characterized by respect of each other. So that is why we felt like we should speak up.
Well, you were in this country when you drew up the statement with the Archbishop.
Yes.
Does your worry partly reflect what you heard and saw of the tone of the debate here?
It certainly also reflected this worry. We have a similar situation in Germany. There are populist parties, one populist party, which tries to divide and which does not help creating reconciliation and cooperation between the countries of Europe. The European project is a peace project that came out of terrible experiences of war, and we need to make sure that this wonderful project of peace and reconciliation and cooperation between the peoples does not get in danger. And the discussions around Brexit, the discussions around refugees are discussions which include voices which try to create identity by putting others down. We need to have a different understanding of identity.
Well, you do talk in the statement about politicians and political forces who are driving a wedge between people. You mentioned a party in Germany. I assume you mean the Alternative for Germany party. Who else do you have in mind when you talk about those who are trying to divide?
It's especially parties who are populist in the sense that they simplify problems, that they attack solution-oriented politics and create emotions which bring people against each other. And those parties, often right-wing populist parties in Europe, they are not a help for a future Europe that is oriented towards the helps peoples and countries to work together in mutual interest.
Germany, I think, today remembers its war dead, as we did last weekend. To what extent is that relevant to this debate, do you think?
Well, that is very relevant because the narratives that form our present understandings are important, and those narratives have a lot to do with the past. For Germany, the memorial culture that has developed after the Second World War is very important for our identity. Today is a day when we think of the millions of dead of the wars, especially in the 20th century, and of course the main emphasis is that this should never happen again. And we as churches, we will celebrate a worship service this morning. I will preach in the concentration camp in Dachau. And we will think of all those people who were brought into the concentration camp in 1938 after the Kristallnacht, and many of them were killed. We want to look at our dark sides. I see it as a sign of strength for our country when we also look at our dark sides.
Bishop Bedford Strom talking to me just before we came on the air. A group of young Christians, Muslims and Jews are being celebrated this week for their contribution to interfaith relations. Three religious media bodies, Jewish News, Muslim TV and the Church Times, have, in cooperation with the interfaith institution Coexist House, drawn up a list of those they want to honour for their contribution to dialogue. And we're going to hear from three of them during today's programme.
My name is Gunan Shang, so I'm a Christian. I became a Christian when I was doing my study. I was involved in an interfaith work called Saturday Morning Breakfast. Basically, we went to a local Somali restaurant in Moorside, Manchester, and developed a conversation and a friendship with the local Muslim community. The idea was simple but powerful. So basically, we just went to that Muslim restaurant each Saturday morning, and we ate pancakes there and have the conversation with the local community. Interfaith is very important to me. I think in a more and more globalized world, so it's very important for us to learn how to respect the difference and celebrate the difference in the society. And as a result, we are able just to put down the barriers in our life. As a result, we are able to develop a relationship and collaborate with each other for a shared goal.
And later in the programme, we'll hear from a Muslim hip-hop singer and a Jewish woman who runs a community cafe. The Codex Amiatinus, the oldest surviving complete text of the Bible in Latin, was produced in northeast England around the year 700 and taken to Rome as a gift to the Pope in 716. It's now, for the first time, back in this country for an exhibition on the Anglo-Saxons at the British Library in London. Harry Farley met the lead curator, Dr. Claire Bray, at the library.
So we've come down some stairs into the start of the exhibition, this dimly lit rabbit warren, and we're surrounded by these ancient texts and ancient manuscripts that are trying to give a picture of what Anglo-Saxon life was like. Three very ancient-looking texts. Just describe what they are.
Well, these three books really are foundational manuscripts for what was to become the Kingdom of England. And here on the left, we've got the St. Augustine Gospels, which is thought to have been brought with St. Augustine's mission to England in 597. And the development of the English language and English literature are really key themes in this exhibition.
And when you say the English language, is it something that I, as not an expert, could read and understand?
The settlers who came from Denmark and what we now know as northern Germany, the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes, were Germanic-speaking peoples, and it was from those Germanic languages that Old English developed. If you listen to somebody reciting the Lord's Prayer, say, in Old English, there are clearly words that you can recognise in modern English today. Here we move into one of the real highlights of the exhibition. This room looks at the golden age of Northumbria, and we have some absolutely spectacular Gospel books, and of course at the far end of the room the great Bible, Codex Amiatinus.
And although we're at the far end of the room to the Codex, it stands out on its own. It's so vast, isn't it? It draws your eye straight away.
This giant book, Codex Amiatinus, which really is one of the greatest treasures of Anglo-Saxon England, is a manuscript of the whole Bible. And it was one of three Bibles that Ceolfrith, the abbot at Wearmouth Jarrow, commissioned at the beginning of the 8th century. Codex Amiatinus survives intact, and it really is a giant. As you can see, the pages are over half a metre tall, and the spine of the book is 30 centimetres thick, a foot thick. So it's a real colossus. Just the production of it must have been an absolutely massive undertaking, because there are 1,030 leaves, parchment leaves, in the book, so over 2,000 pages, wow, of written text. And of course, a team of scribes would have been needed.
In total, it weighs more than 30 kilograms.
That's right, it's over 34 kilograms, so it takes two people to carry it.
Throughout the exhibition, there seems to be a mixture of the supernatural and the natural and the military with the divine. What does it tell us about how devout the Anglo-Saxon people were?
There are a large number of biblical and liturgical books in the exhibition. Many of those are very high status books, and certainly reflects the conversion and the Christianization of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
That was Claire Bray talking to Harry Farley. The statue Lions of the Great War was commissioned by a Sikh temple in Smedic and includes a 10-foot-high figure of a Sikh soldier. It was unveiled just before last weekend's 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, but within days it had been vandalised, defaced by graffiti. To discuss who might be responsible, we're joined by Sunny Hundal, a British Sikh journalist and editor of the Asian online news site Bharti Culture. Good morning.
Morning, Ed.
The police initially, I think, treated this as a racially motivated incident. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I suspect there are some Sikhs behind this, to be honest.
Why?
Well, okay, so there are some Sikhs who feel like the World War One was a colonial war carried out to serve British colonial interests. I mean, I agree with that point. But that leads them to feel that these ceremonies and these memorials are glorifying that war. And they feel that Sikhs were used as pawns and therefore shouldn't be glorified. Now, I think that's sorely mistaken. I think that these soldiers left behind families, they had history, had heritage, and therefore, and also they played a part in this country's history from over 100 years ago. So I think that, you know, they should be remembered. They should be, you know, not glorified, but to me it's remembrance. But if you're the kind of Sikhs who feels like there should be no loyalty to any other nation other than an imagined Sikh nation, then you're going to not celebrate such memorials. And the vandalism around the memorial was done in a way that felt like it was sort of criticizing these people for being part of that war.
Because it used the word sepoys, didn't it? The graffiti that was scribbled on the statue.
Yeah, and it was used in an ironic way, as in sepoys no more, as in, you know, these were what these soldiers were called by the British at the time. So basically saying, you know, we are no longer those kind of sepoys that the British saw us as.
And of course, it's important to say that the statue, as I understand it, certainly wasn't meant to glorify the Raj in any way, and was, I think I'm right in saying, was sort of funded and supported from within the Sikh community.
Yeah, so, I mean, within the Sikh community, there is absolutely a lot of anger at this. So there is a split, you know, debate. I mean, this is a debate amongst Sikhs, to be honest, because this is very much about, do you feel part of this country or not? You know, those who feel like that they don't want to be part of this country because they would much rather have loyalty towards a Sikh nation, a Khalistan, as they call it, then they would think that this is an abomination, or at least certainly, you know, glorifying a nation that they don't want to be part of. Whereas most Sikhs in this country are proud to be British, you know, proud to be, have their identity here, and therefore feel happy with this memorial. So they would feel very angry at this. So there's definitely a brewing debate within the Sikh community about our identity.
Well, we don't, of course, know for sure who did it, but just exploring that division a bit further, how widespread is support for the more radical view of the position of Sikhs that you've just outlined?
Well, they have support when it comes to talking about issues like human rights abuses against Sikhs, especially in India. That's where they get a lot of their support from. When it comes to supporting just an independent Sikh nation, that is where they have far less support, because they are saying we should all fight for an independent Sikh nation, we should have a Sikh nation in India, and this is where our focus should be. And most Sikhs, I would think, that kind of vaguely support that idea in the future, but are not really working towards it. Where there is a very small, hardcore group, a radical group of Sikhs who are much more sort of focused on that goal in a sort of a non-violent way, and they think that Sikhs should focus on this. I would say that I would think they're a very small minority.
And just returning briefly to the question of memorials, I think there's a National Sikh War Memorial due to be unveiled in London in 2020. So this debate is going to go on, isn't it?
Yeah, this debate is absolutely going to go on, and it doesn't really just affect, obviously, war memorials. There's a debate within the Sikh community. You've got a third and second and third generation growing up who they feel that their identity, they're in a bit of an identity conflict, and so this debate is going to be, as it was with Muslims 20 years ago, going to become very, very, I think, angry, perhaps, and certainly more vigorous among Sikhs, British Sikhs.
Sunny Handal, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning.
Thank you.
The government came in for a ferocious assault from the UN's rapporteur on extreme poverty this week. Philip Alston attacked what he called punitive, mean-spirited and often callous austerity policies. The government, of course, challenged that, but it adds an edge to the debate about the church's role. And the latest statistics from the Church of England suggest an intriguing trend. Although attendance at services is down, it seems church members are increasingly likely to be involved in social action projects like food banks. Rajiv Gupta reports.
Around 30 attendees have gathered for a typical weekend service at a church in Manchester. After the sermon has been read, hymns sung and tea and biscuits consumed, the regulars share cordial chit-chat before leaving for home. It's a scene that's replicated at churches across the country.
Loads of those.
So they can be made up like.
But just a few miles away, down the road in Salford, a different type of Christian-led gathering is taking place.
My wife died 4 years ago, and we've been married a long, long time, 57 years. And I got depressed, and my son and my daughter said, "You're not lurking about behind those neck curtains forever." Long story short, I finished up here, where there are a lot of people needed a lot more help than I did.
Barry is just one of hundreds of thousands of people who receive help from Christian-led outreach projects. This one has been organised by Church Action on Poverty. It's a self-reliant group where people are encouraged to start their own businesses. Jane Gosnell is a recovering alcoholic and she leads the group.
I think worship is incredibly important, but I think social action's really vital and we can all pray in our own space as well. But if you think about Jesus' work, it was on the street with ordinary people. And when I see what Church Action on Poverty do working with people, then to me that's the essence of what it's all about.
Do you still go to church on a Sunday?
I'm a little bit of a bad girl some Sundays.
The church has invested millions of pounds trying to halt the decline in attendance. The Bishop of Manchester, David Walker, acknowledges it's had to change the way it engages with its congregations, with social action at the heart of it.
I think we are seeing people engaging differently. We've got to reach out beyond perhaps our traditional comfort zone. Doing a good church is not just making sure there's lots more people who like the things I like, doing the things that I like. It's about how we widen our appeal to meet the spiritual needs and the need that people have to care and love in their communities, to make those a wider range of services available.
there are going to be people that think, well, the church is only doing this because, you know, they want to grow numbers, they want to convert more people to Christianity.
I think we have to be very clear that when we're meeting a social need, there's no sort of evangelistic bit to that. So if I'm feeding you at a food bank, I'm not doing that in order to convert you to the Christian faith. That's not what it's about at all.
Latest Church of England figures suggest that churches are now involved in more than 33,000 social action projects across the country. That's almost three in every parish. Dr. Chris Shanahan from Coventry University is part of a team undertaking research looking at the effectiveness of such projects.
Since the 2010 general election, when Prime Minister David Cameron introduced what he called an age of austerity, we've seen two things happen. The withdrawal of the state, significant cuts in public spending, and as the state has gradually withdrawn, the church has often stepped in.
I mean, do you think the church has been in the position to really tackle or alleviate the effects of austerity?
In some respects, alleviate, yes. But there is a tension. And that tension, I think, revolves around the different understandings that Christians have of the Christian gospel. So there are Christians who will want to challenge very strongly the policies of government and campaign for significant political and economic change. However, there is this ambivalent feeling about pushing too far. If you criticise government too stridently, what happens if I lose a grant for the Breakfast Club or the Food Bank or the Befriending Project?
Hello, Neil.
Hi, pleased to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Church-led projects have given people the opportunity to act on an important principle of their faith, and it's encouraged more people to take part in the church's everyday activities. But criticism that the church has stopped short of striving for real political change is one that's echoed by one of the biggest Christian NGOs, Church Action on Poverty. I've come to their head office hidden away on this industrial estate in Manchester to meet its director, Neil Cooper.
We think they could be doing more. It's not that churches aren't responding to poverty. The challenge for the church is to go upstream and ask the question, what can we do to stop people falling into poverty? And that's where I think there's a bigger role for the church.
It's a criticism that Bishop David Walker rejects.
I think we are tough when we need to be tough. We have said some pretty strong things, particularly about the way in which universal credit has been rolled out. I think there's a lot of work that goes on in terms of working on policy through the conversations that I and others have with government ministers and with other politicians and senior civil servants, that we're engaged in that work all the time. And whatever the general well-being of the population in the country, whether it's austerity or plenty, there's not going to be a shortage of things that the churches can do to show that love of neighbour that goes alongside the love of God.
Back in Salford, Jane Gosnell is adamant that her Christianity will always be one of action rather than words.
In the sense that Christianity or God or faith is everywhere, I just don't think it needs to be restricted to the confines of a once-a-week service. It's not much point going and talking the talk on a Sunday if you're not walking the walk on the other 6 days of the week.
Jane Gosnell, ending that report from Rajiv Gupta. Time's 27 minutes to 8. You're listening to Sunday. Still to come in the programme, we'll discuss the case of the Christian Pakistani woman, Asha Bibi. Would it put British embassy staff in Pakistan at risk to offer her asylum in the United Kingdom? Would it provoke anger among some Muslims here? To celebrate Interfaith Week, which ends today, we're broadcasting comments from three of the young people who have been honoured for their interfaith work by a group of religious media outlets. Here is the second.
My name's Anna Dyson and I'm founder and director of Toast Love Coffee Community Cafe in Leeds. It was the Christmas season in 2012, so I looked to volunteer in a centre for recently arrived asylum seekers, and I met a Christian lady called Anita and her young son who'd recently arrived from Albania, and we just connected and clicked very quickly at that centre. 2 years later we co-founded a cafe that is still going strong. Something I'm very familiar with from being active in my Jewish community, it's called the Kiddush, the time after the service on a Saturday morning where we break bread together. So essentially it's hosting a kiddush whenever the cafe's open. It's hosting a space where you come knowing that you're going to be introduced in a friendly and safe way to someone else and just have a nice conversation together. And then the kindness that comes through from the online community who can't necessarily come into the cafe because they're working or they don't work or live nearby, but want to be part of it and want to be part of the feel-good factor that we all feel. It's just magic.
Anna Dyson. Over the coming weeks, we're going to broadcast a series of interviews on the programme conducted by Dr. Claire Foster-Gilbert, the founder of the Westminster Abbey Institute. The ambition is to give public servants the opportunity to reflect on the moral challenges they face. And for this week's programme, Dr. Foster-Gilbert spoke to David Neuberger, former president of the Supreme Court.
I'm standing in the centre of Parliament Square in London, surrounded by the busy clamour of rush hour traffic. Less audible over the cars and buses, but clearly to be seen, are the busy people who work here. My job is to help the overworked people I can see around me, ruling and running the country, to step back, think more deeply about what it is they're trying to do, and reconnect with the reason why they came into public service in the first place. The UK's constitution is unwritten and difficult to define, but from where I'm standing, it's clearly embodied. To my right, in the Houses of Parliament, where laws are made, in front of me, in the Treasury, and all of Whitehall, where laws are executed, and to my left, in the Supreme Court, where laws are administered. That's where I'm going now to meet David Neuberger, who was president of the Supreme Court, and one of these busy people, until last year. So, David, what made you decide to become a judge? Were there principles and values that drove you?
I don't think I've ever had the feeling that I was dying to change anything radically. I'm not a great believer in big change unless it's absolutely necessary. I think it tends to be disruptive and one doesn't see the disadvantages till it's too late.
As you moved from High Court Judge to Lord Justice of Appeal, Master of the Rolls, and finally President of the Supreme Court, through that long journey, did anything threaten that sense that you were part of a good institution?
Obviously, there were things I regretted, decisions I thought I'd got wrong, and there were decisions that the government made which I thought were wrong. If I had to point to one thing which I think disturbs me, it is the government's failure to provide proper financial and administrative basis for the judiciary and more widely for the rule of law. That is what worries me most. I think as a country we take the rule of law for granted, we take our judges, we take the legal system for granted. My worry is that if we lose it, which we might, if we lose a first-class system, it will be very difficult to resurrect, and the government hardly even talks the talk, let alone walks the walk on that.
So are you pessimistic about the future of the rule of law and the respect that in which it should be held in the country?
I'm not pessimistic, I'm worried. I think it's very difficult to predict how the government will act and whether they'll do anything. But I think there is cause for concern, and over the period I've been a judge, the concern has accentuated. I mean, it's typified by Legal Aid, which until 1999 in the civil field was quite reasonable. 95% of people who become High Court judges take a significant cut. You don't do it for the money. It's now a more significant cut. There comes a point where, and it may have come, where people are put off simply because of the money. But the message that the government sends by slashing, in effect, pay, because pension is part of pay, is a very bad one. It means we don't really value you. And that's not a message that's very sensible to send if you want to have a high-quality judiciary.
In the UK, we have both statute law and common law.
Yes.
Statute law made by Parliament, common law made by judges developing yes. precedent. What I'd really like to hear from you is what it feels like to have that responsibility of setting precedent that could last down the centuries. How did you make sure you measured up to that responsibility?
Some judges don't have many doubts. Some judges are plagued by doubts, and I was closer to the latter category. Yeah, I did worry. I wanted to get it right, but I think I probably worried whether I was making the law or interpreting the law, whether it was interpreting a statute or making it. I tended to be something of a swing vote. I did worry. The worst thing I think I do and did is to worry after I've made the decision, which is completely pointless.
I'm thinking now about a case like the Charlie Gard case, mm-hmm. where the judgment had to be made. Mm-hmm. It was also devastating for the family. How did you feel about the effect it had on the family, even though you might have felt satisfied that the judgment that was made was the right one?
I think in any area, whether it's medicine or law or other areas, where you have to make decisions which will upset people, you have, on the one hand, to insulate yourself against feeling too sorry for them. Otherwise, you'll have a nervous breakdown. While at the same time trying to do everything you can to soften any blow which you are professionally bound to administer. I mean, you do feel as a judge when you have to give people bad news and you wrap it up and you're kind to them, as kind as you properly can be. You sometimes feel these are words being said for my benefit to make me feel better.
What resources do you call on when things are really wrenching inside and hard to cope with? How do you look after your own moral and spiritual health, you might say, so that you don't turn into an automaton, you retain your humanity, but you don't tear yourself to pieces?
I think you're right. You have to be careful if you do a lot of these cases not to get too hard-skinned, too unfeeling. But I suspect the greater danger is being overwhelmed by it.
If I were an aspiring lawyer and I wanted to become a judge, but imagine I'm just really incredibly idealistic, would that idealism survive?
Well, if you're incredibly idealistic, it won't survive whatever you do. I mean, the great strength, or one of the great strengths of the common law, is that it's practical and realistic. And if you are, quote, incredibly idealistic, unquote, the risk is that you have an unrealistic expectation, and you will be disappointed, and your attitude to the law may be too perfectionist and not practical enough. I think you have to temper your idealism with realism. But if you've been a practicing lawyer, and almost all judges have been practicing lawyers, it's quite difficult to maintain an incredible idealism after you've been a practicing lawyer for some time.
Lord Neuberger talking to Claire Foster Gilbert, and you can listen to a longer version of that interview on our website and on the BBC Sounds app. And here now is the last in the series of comments from young people honoured for their interfaith work this week.
My name is Mohamed Yahya. I am a bilingual rapper. My first language is Portuguese. I was born in Mozambique, Southeast Africa. Myself, my family, and we fled to Lisbon, which is the capital of Portugal, until I was 10 years old before I moved to London. My father and my mother never imposed any faith, and they always taught me religion is more than what you do on a Friday in a mosque or on a Sunday in church. It's a way of life, and it's up to me, and eventually I converted to Islam. My music is a reflection of my life. Every single painting, a vision supreme, vividly serene, envision the scene. Beyond concrete skies, our dreams will arise. Gradually. Like outside of my music, I wanted to get involved in interfaith work. P5P is an amazing project. I've had the opportunity to work very closely with West London Synagogue, and it's a Muslim Sunday school. And what we do is we get a group of children from the synagogue and a group of children from the Muslim Sunday school. I deliver multiple workshops where we explore identity, we explore stereotypes, comparative religion. From that project, remarkable relationships and friendships are born.
Mohamed Yahya. The government is coming under pressure from several sources, MPs, church leaders and some imams, to offer asylum to Asia Bibi, the Pakistani Christian woman who was recently cleared of blasphemy charges 10 years after being sentenced to death. And at the beginning of the week, the head of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Sir Simon MacDonald, faced some challenging questions at the Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee over the FCO's position on the case. Conservative MP Tom Tugendhat chairs the committee and is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Edward.
And what he essentially said was that the safety of British staff in Pakistan was a factor in deciding how the government should respond on this matter, which is a reasonable position, isn't it?
Well, it is, of course, a reasonable position, but it then begs a follow-on question, which is if British government policy is being decided because we cannot secure the safety of our staff, we have two options. One is either to change the security position of our staff by withdrawing some or increasing security, or two, changing the policy of the United Kingdom. Now, the problem with the latter is it means that effectively the policy of the British government, the policy of the British people, which has always been to support freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, should not be subject to the rule of the mob by a Pakistani mob or indeed by any other mob.
And that's so, really what you think is happening here, is it?
Well, there's a great concern amongst members of the committee that that is what's happening, because if we are afraid of the mob, and that's why we're not offering asylum to a woman who so clearly on every level counts, on every possible metric, is clearly eligible for asylum in the United Kingdom and indeed in other countries, but we're not willing to offer it because of concern over our own safety, then we have to either change the position of our own safety and make sure we don't require that, you know, we shouldn't be afraid, or we have to ask ourselves very serious questions about who we're bowing down to.
Well, we put this matter to the Home Office, of course, who'd be essential to the asylum decision if it came to it, and they quoted back to us what the Prime Minister has said, which is that a number of countries are in discussions about providing a safe destination for her once the legal process in Pakistan is complete. In pragmatic terms, is that not a sensible policy to pursue?
Of course, it's absolutely right that we should look for the best circumstance for Asia Bibi. Now, it may be indeed that the UK isn't the best place. It may be that somewhere else is the best place. But the idea that we're not offering the best place—sorry—that we're not making an offer, not because we've found a better place, but simply because we're afraid, really does call into question the ability of the United Kingdom to project influence and to support the issues that we think are right.
She is a Catholic, Asia Bibi, and you are a Catholic. Is this, in more general terms, an area where you feel the government is being insufficiently robust in protecting Christians suffering this kind of persecution?
For me, it's not to do with my own religious faith. That, I'm afraid, in this circumstance, is irrelevant. It's about freedom of expression. It's quite right, for example, that we should stand up for the rights of minorities in various different communities, whether that's Muslims in the Balkans, as you know, Edward, we fought a war to protect Muslims in the Balkans, particularly those in Kosovo and Bosnia. We have certainly changed our policy towards certain countries on their treatment of homosexuality, and we have changed our policy towards countries when they have excluded other minorities, particularly, for example, the Rohingya community and other Muslim community in Burma. So the idea that we shouldn't change our policy in Pakistan simply because she's a Christian, or indeed simply because we're afraid of the mob, strikes me as extremely odd.
Well, stay with us if you could, because we're also joined by Dr. Usama Hassan of the anti-extremist Quillian Foundation. He's one of the imams supporting Asia Bibi, and also by John Pontifex of Aid to the Church in Need. John Pontifex, you, I think, are in touch with her family. What sort of state are they in?
Well, I spoke to them last night, and they reiterated once again their concerns for their own safety. The family are having to move from one location to another, so they're almost like people who are fugitives moving around. Sometimes they're having to conceal their identity, and they're increasingly concerned as to what might just happen to them. And we know that they're being concerned about the provision of food for them, and they're desperate to be properly reunited with Asia Bibi themselves, and the hope of getting a new place outside of Pakistan is essential for them at this stage.
And are they being protected by the authorities?
That particular position is unclear, but what is clear is that whatever protection is provided is not sufficient, and hence the need in their eyes for them to find a new future outside Pakistan.
And what's your understanding of where that process has got to?
Well, it's not clear quite what stage we've got with regard to the possibility for a final conclusion to the legal processes by which Asia Bibi would indeed be allowed to take the option to leave. There's this question of the exit control list, whether she would be put on it. There are reports that that particular possibility has now passed. And indeed, there's always been this possibility that the court's decision, the acquittal decision, would be reviewed. But reports are indicating that may not now take place. But we can but see, all the while, we have to remember that Imran Khan is very conscious of the TLP, the Tehreek-e-Labbaik party, and the very real possibility that they could call more protests, which could place a huge stranglehold over the country and effectively bring it to its knees.
Usama Hassan, you are one of those, I think, who signed a letter saying that she should be allowed to come to this country, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And why do you feel so strongly about that?
Well, because it's the moral thing to do. As the MP said earlier, this is something the United Kingdom is known for and has done for a long time. And of course, there's a special relationship, if you like, between Britain and Pakistan, Britain being the former colonial power. And the British Empire actually helped to spread Christianity in India and what is now Pakistan. I believe there's almost a kind of moral responsibility on Britain to be especially concerned about this. In a sense, Asia Bibi's ancestors, her family, probably converted to Christianity with British help, if you like, or with British influence. So that's an added factor, but it's the moral thing to do to help in this situation, to work with the Pakistanis and other governments to find a safe place for us here.
One of the arguments that causes concern is the possibility that if she was given asylum here, it might provoke a very angry reaction from some sections of the Muslim community in Britain. Do you think that's true?
There's always that possibility, but I think times have moved on. I mean, in a couple of months, it will be 30 years since the Salman Rushdie situation or the fatwa from Iran. And if you look back to the angry protests and death threats and things in those times, then you look at the situation now where several imams, including myself, and a couple of dozen Muslim community activists and leaders of a different generation have openly signed this letter calling for asylum. I think we shouldn't be too afraid about that. The British Pakistani community in this country is about 1 million strong. They reflect all the different political and religious views in Pakistan. But I think the vast majority believe in religious freedom and freedom of speech. They find this an embarrassment to Pakistan that a small minority of violent fanatics, if you like, can make these threats. And we wish that the governments of Britain and Pakistan would show more resolve and say we're not going to bow down, we're not going to cave in to this kind of intimidation.
But you deal with extremism. Do you think it is a threat that we should take seriously, even if you think we should be more robust about it?
Yes, I do, partly because of the high-profile nature of the case. Obviously, there are various cases brought like this, but this would be big news. But, the government, Britain is a huge country, the government is certainly able to house a family in a secure location somewhere without people knowing about it.
Tom Tugendhat, just returning to you, do you think that's a serious concern that the government needs to take into account, the possibility of anger among some Muslims here?
I have to say, I think that says very negative things about the government's perception of the Muslim community in the UK. I have had many, many dealings over many years with Muslims in the UK, including an incredibly heroic imam, the armed forces, Hafiz Asim. And he and many others have demonstrated to me very clearly how the Muslim community in the UK works extremely well with the rest of the community and is, broadly speaking, in line with British thinking. So the idea that, diplomats, as I was in Helmand, shouldn't be taking risks. I was blown up twice by roadside bombs and attacked several times because we thought the policy mattered, because we thought that it was important to try and bring governance to Helmand. Well, if we don't think it's important to bring to protect people with freedom of conscience in Pakistan, we should say so, but we shouldn't be two-faced on this.
We must leave it there. Tom Tugendhat, John Pontifex of Aid to the Church in Need, and Dr. Usama Hassan, thank you all very much indeed for talking to us this morning. If you'd like to comment on today's programme, you can email us, sunday@bbc.co.uk, or write to us, Dockhouse, Media City UK, Salford, M50 2LH. William Crawley will be in the chair next weekend. Enjoy your Sunday.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.